getting started up here. Good to see everyone back again. I will remind folks, I'll share it here and there. In fact, I'll do so in a minute. But there is a document that is sort of with some supplemental things or things that I type in from time to time, which you can see over here. So if you want to go to that, there's some supplementary materials that I'm going to refer to in there. And we'll actually start off with a little bit from there tonight to just get a sense of what's behind the sugya that we're getting to. Okay, so welcome back, everyone. Hope everyone had a good week and is getting ready for Shavuot. And yeah, we're going to jump back in here with our next sugya. Okay, so we are going back again, our long Mishnah that's been going through over and over, talking about the things that are different between Dinei Mamonot and Dinei Nefashot, civil law and criminal law. And the next thing in the list, I'll just read for you back in the Mishnah, is Dinei Mamonot, Hakol Milamdim Zechut Vechova, Dinei Nefashot, Hakol Milamdim Zechut, Ve'ein Hakol Milamdim Chova. So in civil law, monetary cases, everyone can teach either for the benefit, the person being sued, or against them to their detriment. But in Dinei Nefashot, in capital cases, everyone is entitled to teach for the benefit in defense of the defendant, but not all are allowed to teach chova, to teach to the detriment of the accused. So our Mishnah, our sugya is going to go into the question basically of who is in this hakol, okay? Who is included in this universal, this sort of comprehensive statement of who is allowed to teach in favor of people? And in perhaps in favor or against people in the case of Dinei Mamonot. Okay, so we can see here a little bit some of what is being discussed. Okay, so this question of who is speaking up, okay, is an important one that comes up in a number of cases. And we've got to get a little bit of a picture of what's happening here. This will help us understand our sugya and get a little bit of a picture of who's in the room. And in particular, you'll see there's a whole kind of discussion of the talmidim, okay? A group of people who are like students who are in the room, who somehow, at least sometimes, have the authority, the prerogative to speak up and affect the outcome of the trial. Okay, so here in the Mishnah on my screen here, okay? This is from the fifth chapter, which is talking a little bit more about the procedures. Achar kach machnisin et hasheni. Afterwards, they bring in the second witness, okay? So obviously this is coming at the point in the trial where there's already a first witness has been brought. Uvodkin oto, and you check the second witness. Im nimtzeu divreihem mechuvanim, if their stories match up, you start with arguments in favor, all right? And this is in the context of a capital case, all right? This is the narrative of what happens in a capital case. As we saw in an earlier sugya, you always start off the proceeding in a capital case arguing for why the person should get off. Amar echad min ha'edim yesh li lelamed alav zechut. O echad min ha'talmidim, יש לי ללמד עליו חובה, משתקין אותו. אמר אחד מן התלמידים, יש לי ללמד עליו זכות, מעלין אותו, מושיבין אותו ביניהם. ולא היה יורד משם כל היום כולו. אם יש ממש בדבריו, שומעין לו. Okay, so if at the point where you open up the proceedings, one of the witnesses says, I have an argument in favor of letting this guy off. That is to say, someone who already testified in the capital case now says, I have an argument for this person to be let off. Alternatively, you have one of the students. So this is this truth, this group of people, it seems to be important. I have a Talmid in the room who says, I have something to the detriment of the defendant to say. Mishatkinoto, you silence them. All right, so this is two important points. The first is that even though you're beginning with zechut, the witnesses are barred from making that comment. Okay, the witnesses are not eligible to come in and to say, I've got something that I think is exculpatory, or I have an argument from the Torah as to why this person should be let off. But one of the Talmidim, if one of the students who's not a part of the court says, hey, I have a damning argument against this person, you silence them because potrin bizchut. But if one of the Talmidim says, I have an exonerating argument, well, then not only do you listen to the student, you bring the student up and seat him with the other members of the court, and he doesn't go down from there for the rest of the day. And indeed, if there's something to the argument that he offered, you follow it. Okay, so it's sort of like, imagine there's just like, there's someone in the courtroom, basically, who will suddenly almost, this is an imperfect parallel, but it's like suddenly impaneled in the jury because they have something that's going to potentially let the defendant off. But the witness to the case is disbarred from saying anything, okay? So that's our first segment here that's giving us a little bit of context, okay? Yeah, great question. Does it apply to all witnesses or just those who testified to the defendant's guilt? Stick with us and we'll see, all right? And you can tell me what you think as we go. Now, a next piece which will be important later is then they deliberate all night, venosin venotznin kol alayla ulemachorat, and the next morning, remember, capital cases you have to sleep on them. Mashkimim, they get up early, uvain levet din, and they come into court. Hamizaket, omer, ani mizaket, umizaket ani bimkomi. Vamachayev omer, ani machayev, umechayev ani bimkomi. Everyone sort of reports and says, I am one of those who, you know, offered an argument to exonerate, and I remain in that place. And the person who says, I have evidence to convict, or I voted to convict, and I remain in the place of conviction. They sort of state where they're holding. Hamelamed chova, melamed zechut, the one who taught to convict, can come back around then and be melamed zechut, teach something that's exonerating. Aval hamelamed zechut eino yachol lechzor lamed chova. Once you are in the position of having offered an argument in favor of the defendant, you cannot back out. We saw a version of this in our Mishnah in our chapter, but here we see it as part of the narrative of what happens, and that's going to be important later. Okay, that's the Mishnah. Now I want to go forward here to the Tosefta. And again, keeping track of this will help us really understand how the sugya comes together. Amar echad min haTalmidim. So the Tosefta is parallel. It's not continuous with what came before. It's just a parallel source describing the capital trial process. If one of these students says, "Yesh li lelamed alav zechut, mikablin oto besever panim yafot, umaalinu moshivin oto imahem." So here we get a little more color. If one of those students offers an exonerating argument, you sever panim yafot. That's what Shammai HaZaken said you always have to have. A good countenance. That is to say, with good cheer. They're like, good for you. You had some argument to exonerate and you bring him up. Im yesh mamash bidvarav patruhu. If, you know, it was a good argument, then they exonerated the person and dismissed the charges. Velo hayar yored misham olamit. Ve'im lav lo yored misham koloto ayom. Kedei shelo tehe aliyato yirida lo. This is just sort of a comment that if you ever made an argument that got someone off in a death penalty case, you were basically entitled for life to sit in the judge's seats. All right, the next line seems to be, and if that didn't actually happen, at least you would stay up there all day. That is to say, the Mishnah's framing of you were up there all day seems to be a sort of more minimal manifestation of what the Tosefta imagines was the ideal. And you can imagine that would be a kind of incentive for people to figure out arguments that might let people off of the death penalty, because you then basically get an honored seat in the Sanhedrin for the rest of your life. Again, continuing here, Husha Yomar, Yeshli Lelameda Lai Zechut, Shominlo, Chova Mishatkinoto. This is about the defendant himself. Here's the key part for our purposes. Ha'ed Eino Melamed Lo Zechut Velo Chova. The witness may not teach either for the benefit or to the detriment of the defendant. So that maps onto the ruling we saw in the Mishnaic passage above, where it said, if a witness speaks up to exonerate the person, you silence them, right? And that corresponds to, ha'ed eino melamed lo zechut velo chova. But here we see that was not universal. Rabbi Yosef and Rabbi Yehuda omer, melamed zechut ve'ein melamed chova. Rabbi Yosef and Rabbi Yehuda actually thought that a witness was allowed to weigh in on the proceedings as long as it was an argument to exonerate. All right, that'll be important for our sugya. That point that seems to be unanimous in Mishnah Hay apparently is only one view as recorded here in the Tosefta, and Rabbi Yosef and Rabbi Yehuda thinks about it differently and allows a witness to sort of cross lines and suddenly behave a little bit like a judge, as long as it's going in the right direction, okay? There are a few other sources here that weigh in on this, and then I'll pause for a question. You'll see these in detail in a moment, but you've got this pasuk in Bamidbar, kol makei nefesh lefi edim yirtzach et harotzeach, ve'ed echad lo ya'aneh v'nefesh lamut. Anyone who murders someone, kills someone, you can only kill the murderer with witnesses. And the emphasis here in the pshat is lefi edim in the plural. Ve'ed echad, which is to say, however, one witness, lo ya'aneh v'nefesh lamut. One witness cannot speak up to cause someone to die. Now that just seems like it is a straight up application of what we've seen elsewhere in the Torah of you can't kill someone. Quite frankly, you can't do anything meaningful with one witness, right? You need two witnesses. But we've already heard that elsewhere in the Torah. So of course the Midrashic mind will say, well, this verse has to be adding something else. Alpi shnei edim yakum davar, that's already said elsewhere. So the Sifrei B'Midbar here reports, ve'ed echad lo ya'aneh v'nefesh lamut, one witness cannot speak up to kill someone, onehu bo lizchut, but a single witness can speak up to let someone off. Okay, that is to say, a single witness, according to this verse, according to this interpretation of the verse, is not disqualified as evidence. It's just it does not have the power to convict someone, but it is still relevant as evidence to get someone off. Note, this is not what the Mishnah was talking about just a minute ago. This is not a witness in the case suddenly speaking up. This is a more basic point of, can you admit as testimony in a capital case a single witness who says, he was with me at this other place, right? Can a single witness provide an alibi? Or do two witnesses, are two witnesses the only kind of evidence we admit? Here the Sifrei says, a single witness is valid because a close reading will indicate ve'ed echad lo ya'aneh v'nefesh lamut. To kill someone, you can't use one witness, but to save someone's life, one witness is enough. Okay? Now, the final piece here is this other verse that I mentioned, al pi shnayim edim, o shlosha edim yumat amed, lo yumat al pi ed echad. This is another verse that says you cannot kill people based on one witness, but it's not even the only remaining verse of this sort. So here too, we're like, well, we know that principle. What is this adding? And here the Sifrei Dvarim, the early Midrash Halacha and Dvarim says, Minayin shelo yilamed eid echad chova, Talmud lomar lo yumat al pi eid echad. How do we know that a single witness cannot weigh in to kill someone? Well, that's taught by this verse, lo yumat al pi eid echad. You can't kill someone based on one witness. But now, uminayin shelo yilamed talmid chova, Talmud lomar lo yumat al pi eid echad. How do we also know that a student, and here we're back to these ancillary figures in the courtroom, how do we know a student can never argue for chova? Only a judge can argue for chova. That comes from the verse, the same phrasing, lo yumat al pi eid echad. The same verse, it seems here, also teaches that this eid echad is not only not just a witness in the case itself, not only just a single person who comes forward with exculpatory evidence, it's also an expression for anyone who is sort of not in a significant position. Eid echad here comes to mean not just a single witness entering testimony in a formal way, but like an eid echad, some stray voice in the courtroom, that is to say a Talmid can come out of the gallery to exonerate a person in a capital case. A Talmid can never come out of the gallery in order to convict or to provide damning evidence, all right? These are the background pieces that are now gonna guide us through, take us through our sugya. But you see here two things that'll be important in what we're about to do. One, some actual substantive engagement with who is able to speak up at what points. And then perhaps a little more subtly buried in this last text, the notion that you might take the same verse to teach multiple points of law, which is gonna end up also being of interest to our sugya. Okay, let me pause there. If there are comments or life and legal experience that is relevant to share on this with from any of our participants, feel free to chat or jump in on that. And we'll move in a second to the sugya. Yeah, a couple comments here in the chat to respond to. Earlier, I thought we said you can't do stuff with capital cases at night. That is correct. You cannot, but it is focused indeed on reaching a verdict. And that nosin v'notnin, that discussion piece that's happening at night, seems to be to give more window to allow them to undo the potential conviction that they might be arriving at. So yes, you're right to spot that the night piece is significant, and we'll come back to that later in the chapter. But the key thing when we say that danin, that you do sort of judgment of capital cases, is you can't deliver a verdict at night. Okay, and then David here, the defendant, similar like a patient. Everyone watches the attendings, that's nice. Yeah, I think that's right, exactly. You're giving it with this, there's both a training apprenticeship piece, but there's also this tendentious desire on some level for a certain outcome. And maybe there, right? Maybe there's also something of having a few more eyes on it, you know, it's not that you're gonna trust that person to like withhold medication, but maybe they'll catch something that the attending isn't seeing. Yes, and Jed, process of deliberation. Okay, well, let's see. Let's see where it goes. I think this is one of those cases where they have an imagination of what it is. I'm not sure we have such a robust live record, you know, of what it was. Okay, great. Let's go on here and see how the sugya actually plays out. Okay, so we are here. Hakol, all right, remember the phrase here being everyone, dine mamonot, anyone can offer arguments in favor or against the person being sued, but not everyone can do so in the context of capital cases. Okay, so the Gemara's first question, Vafilu Edim, do you mean to say even witnesses? When you say everyone can offer it, really? Even witnesses? Neima matnitin Rabbi Yose b'Rabbi Yehuda hi velo Rabbanan. Well, that would then mean that our Mishnah must follow Rabbi Yose b'Rabbi Yehuda and not his majority interlocutor, described here as Rabbanan. D'tanya, and here we get a version of that position we saw in the Tosefta. Ve'ed echad lo ya'ane b'nefesh. Bein lizchut, bein lechova. Rabbi Yose b'Rabbi Yehuda omer, one lizchut, ve'ein one lechova. So the Braita here being quoted basically nicely shows us how you might splice the verse in different ways. The verse is ve'ed echad lo ya'ane b'nefesh lamut. So how does the Tanakhama read it? The first view reads it as Eid Echad lo ya'ane b'nefesh. Like that's all you need to read to understand what's going on. A single witness does not speak up against someone. Okay? Like they're just not allowed to speak up. And Eid Echad here is being read as one of the people, right, who is already a witness, which is what it was in the Tosefta. Someone who already has testified in the case is disqualified from speaking up. But Rabbi Yosef Rabbi Yehuda says, he is allowed in a capital case to speak up in favor, but he is not allowed to speak up against. So when we go back to the Mishnah's framing, dinei nefashot, hakol milamdin zechut, ve'ein hakol milamdin chova, okay, that in a capital case, everyone can teach to exonerate the person. If that everyone includes an aid, then you are making the Mishnah only accord with Rabbi Yosef Rabbi Yehuda's view, right? Because the first view in the Braita here thinks, no, bein l'schud, bein l'chova, you're not allowed to speak up if you are already a witness. And why is that implausible? Well, basically, it's implausible because Rabbi Yosef Rabbi Yehuda is a minority view, and why would the Mishnah just sort of randomly only teach the minority view as opposed to the majority? Okay, so Rav Papa is going to come along and say, it can't be aid. It can't refer to an aid. Hakol must be an expansive phrase, but that is to signify someone else. Amar Rav Papa, be'echad min ha-talmidim v'divrei hakol. Okay? That is to say, Rav Papa wants to say, the Hakol in our Mishnah refers not to the large scope of people that includes the witnesses, but to the scope of people that is larger than the court. This is teaching us, clarifying for us, that even people who are, you know, students, who are the law clerks, as it were, can step up and say something. And it thereby accords with everyone. It's not weighing in on the debate of those two Tanaim of Rabbi Yosef Rabbi Yehuda. So now the Gemara is going to ask here, my Tama de Rabbi Yosef Bar Yehuda, why, what is his basis, which we haven't learned yet? Amar kra, eid echad lo ya'ane b'nefesh lamut. Lamut hu de'eino oneh, aval yizchut oneh. Right, that's what we just saw a minute ago. Actually, the presence in the verse of the word lamut is meant to emphasize very clearly that the ban on a witness speaking up, Eid Echad here read as one of the witnesses who testified in the case, that is meant to limit that to cases where it will kill him if you speak up, but if you're doing it to get him off, then you are good to go. There's no problem. V'Rabbanan, now we get into one of these sort of midrash ping-pongs. Why don't the Chachamim, right? How do they sort of process this, right? Rabbanan, who are against Rabbi Yosef Rabbi Yehuda, okay? Why do they think, right? What is their basis, sort of what is their concern for why someone shouldn't be able to speak up as a witness and exonerate someone? Amar Reish Lakish, Mishum de mechaze kenogea be'eduto. It will compromise their testimony. All right. So let's look at Rashi here. He gives us a nice explanation. Rabbanan de amre afilu lizchut lo ya'ane. the majority position, which says that the witness is never allowed to speak up, even if it will exonerate the person who's on the block. Mishum de nogeyahu bidavar shemitcharet bo, because it impacts, compromises something that he will regret or potentially might regret. V'do'eg shema yigamer hadin lechova, v'yavi ze edim lahaziman, u'mihadar lo matzi hadre baho la'achar kedei dibur, v'cheivan sheigid shuv eno chozer u'magid. What is the witness worried about? He's worried about that maybe the person will be convicted based on his testimony, right? In other words, he testified against this person that he was guilty of a capital crime. And now he's worried, oh shoot, maybe he's gonna actually be convicted. I wasn't fully thinking that through when I testified, but the concern is not really for the well-being necessarily of the defendant, but the fear is, what will then happen? He will be convicted, and then the defendant will bring edim, will bring witnesses to invalidate my testimony. That is to say, will turn me into an ed zomim, will turn me into a conspiring witness. And even though it seems the person here is not actually a conspiring witness, but they're worried. Sometimes, you know, a court could accept as evidence something that's not actually right. The second witnesses will be more successful conspirators and be able to prove that the first ones were conspirators, even though they weren't. And suddenly, basically, he freaks out by testifying in a capital case. I have put my own life on the line. And so what will he do? He will speak up and try to advance an argument to get the guy off, because he's now terrified that he, as a witness, will potentially be executed as an ed zomim. Your obvious question is, why doesn't he just back out of his testimony? That would be the simpler way to do it. And that's why Rashi clarifies, he cannot back out once he has completed his testimony. Once you have entered the testimony, there is no way to back out. All right, so this, I think this came up briefly last time, but just a quick question for any of the lawyers and judges here, feel free to unmute. How does that work in contemporary American law? Someone enters testimony and then they say they want to revise it or retract it. I know we have some people here who know. And I don't know if it's different civil criminal. Yeah, Jed, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, that can happen if you're the one who's put that witness on. It's usually a bad day for you at trial. And look, that's the whole point of one of the points of cross-examination, right? So the fact that both lawyers examine the witness kind of collapses what the witness wants to say and what the witness might say if pressed into a single testimony. But I'm not aware of any rule that says in any context, I'm aware of that once a witness has testified, if the proceeding is still ongoing, the witness can't alter his or her testimony.
Right. Part of this, I imagine, goes to something we've talked about lots, and particularly when we were doing the third chapter, that the whole system of evaluating testimony and evidence is just sort of based much more on credibility. So that'll be a major factor in terms of, do we believe anything? Whereas this system is much more almost like, you know, you get the two witnesses together, their stories match, they almost create an entity that is now separate from themselves or anything they would say that you must take consideration of. And you can't dismiss.
In fact, it happens all the time that witnesses say something and then they're asked about it, sometimes by the same lawyer, sometimes by the other side's lawyer, and they end up with a slightly different version of the story. And it's often the case that a witness will have given a statement earlier and what they testified to at trial isn't exactly the same thing as what they said before. And that becomes an issue of credibility. And there are various different rules depending on the context in which the earlier statement was made. But the whole point of witnesses is that they're telling the facts, and their version of the facts sometimes changes. And sometimes I've had some cases where witnesses just flat out said, no, I didn't tell the truth that time. Now I'm telling the truth. And that's why defense lawyers sometimes really do get up and say, Were you lying then or are you lying now?
Mm-hmm. Great. Okay. Not just on TV.
it happens more on TV, but it happens in real life too.
Great. Okay. Fantastic. Thank you for those reports from the field and the context. So you see here, this is working very differently. Again, how much in practice, how much in theory, but the notion that, no, the testimony kind of has a life of its own. You can't back out of it. Going back to Reish Lakish's point, given the assumption that you cannot back out of your testimony, we then worry that a witness is standing up in the middle of the proceedings and saying, I have an argument to exonerate, is actually self-interested because they are nervous that they have now been implicated in a capital proceeding where their life might be on the line because of the law of Edim Zomamin, the conspiratorial witnesses who will then be executed if it's turned out that they convicted an innocent man or a man that they did not have the, you know, actually the goods on. So that's Reish Lakish's explanation of why the Chachamim are like, no, the witness cannot weigh in at all. And then that thought is sort of completed. V'rabanan haylamut mai dar sheve. Okay, that's like a good logical argument, but you do still have this word lamut in the Torah, which seems to be narrowing. So what do you do with that? Mokmei lebe achad min ha-talmidim. That they apply to the students. That is to say, these law clerks, these apprentices, etc. They are allowed to speak up for life, but not for death. That's the last text that I did with you as prep for this. Amar echad min ha'edim, yesh li lelamed alav zechut, minayin she'en shomin lo, tamud lomar, eid echad lo ya'aneh. Right, how do we know that one of the witnesses cannot speak up, no matter what? Because it says, eid echad lo ya'aneh, any of the individual witnesses simply cannot speak up. Minayin le'echad min ha'talmidim, she'amar yesh li lelamed alav chova, minayin she'en shomin lo, Tamud lamar, echad lo ya'aneh b'nefesh lamut. All right, so here you have the reading of, it's eid echad lo ya'aneh, tells you a witness cannot speak up, and chop off the word eid at the beginning and append the word lamut that we chopped from the end, you'll get echad lo ya'aneh b'nefesh lamut. Here in the Bavli's reading of it, it's a little more playful than in what we saw in the Midrash Halacha. An individual, that is to say, someone who is of no consequence, cannot speak up against a person to lead them to their death. But the implication being a person of no consequence can speak up to exonerate a person and get them out of being convicted. Okay? So that's basically our little sugya there about questions of who gets to speak up and an attempt to generate from the verses what is otherwise a protocol that seems to have been pretty clear, which is sort of junior marginal legal figures in the courtroom are given an unusual voice only in the direction of exoneration in capital cases, whereas witnesses, according to the majority view, are not allowed to speak up at all. But note, there was this minority view of Rabbi Yosef Rabbi Yehuda that felt otherwise. I'll also note that interesting scene that talks about how when a student offers evidence of exoneration, they then get seated on the court, at least for the day, if not for the rest of their life. So one way of reading that is it's like an incentive, right, for people to do that. Another way may be some degree of sense of, look, we want people to exonerate people when they have good arguments, but there's some sense of maybe the dignity and coherence of the system. Like, we have to then treat that person like a judge, because otherwise we're just taking suggestions from the peanut gallery. That may be too extreme, even when we're tendentiously looking to let people off. Yeah, okay, I'll pause there if there's some further thoughts, couple things in the chat. Yeah, how common is a midrash where you chop a verse in such a way? Not uncommon. It's not uncommon. I mean, obviously, you know, there's v'chata'a v'nake, obviously, you know, as one of the most famous breaking up of a verse where v'nake lo yinake gets split in two. This is a little less violent than that. Yeah, it'll happen. I think here, you know, some of the way you have to read these midrashim is less as, oh, this is a plausible way to parse the prose, and more in the sort of poetic sense of, well, ultimately, like, what words am I hearing together? I've said this a number of times. I think, like, if you are a Torah reader with any regularity, you appreciate a lot more of what's going on in Midrash, because separate from thinking about the words mean, you have sort of the role of words just rolling in your head. And that's part of what they're listening to in that kind of context.
Isn't there a halacha that a Kohen who on Yom Kippur fills in for the Kohen Gadol who became impure, he becomes a Kohen Gadol and he always remains a Kohen Gadol?
That's correct. And I think that's, in a way, an interesting conceptual parallel to the latter point I was saying, which is it may be sort of some element of like, well, once that person has gone into the Holy of Holies, like they went into the Kodesh HaKodeshim, how can you, for the dignity of the system, actually treat them, you know, as any lesser? And that may be something else that's going on here. Great. Okay. And some further thoughts here on retraction that are helpful and some back and forth. Fantastic. Okay, good. Let's go on to our next sugya. We'll see if we can at least see the first half of this, if not the whole thing, at least in schematic form. Okay, so now, next piece of our Mishnah. First, the first part. Dinei mamonot, ha-melamed chova, melamed zechut, va-melamed zechut, melamed chova. In monetary civil cases, you can flip back and forth your opinion a million times. That doesn't matter as a judge. You can say, I see it this way. Well, actually, I see it this way. I want to argue for this outcome. Actually, now this seems more right. Once in a capital case, you have weighed in on the side of exoneration, you cannot go back and argue for conviction. But if you have argued for conviction, you can flip to the other side. Another structural bias in trying to get to exonerations as opposed to convictions, or, you know, trying to avoid wrongful convictions basically at all costs. Now, but the question is, how far does this go? And we saw in the intro that I did, we saw briefly that it seems like, right, they come back on that next day in the description of how they come back. Okay, it indeed says, right, if you remember that part where it describes the people who voted, you know, to exonerate, say, I voted to exonerate, and here I am in the same place. And if you vote to, voted to convict, you show up and you say, I voted to convict. And then the statement later on in the Mishnah, again, you can flip from conviction to exoneration, but not vice versa. Okay, but then in Tosefta, there's an ambiguity, okay, in one of the texts there that makes it unclear as to whether that is only about the deliberation process. That is to say, whether while you're in the deliberating process, basically, you can line up with conviction and turn back and argue the other way. But you cannot, right, go in the opposite direction. But when it comes to vote, you can vote however you want. Or whether this is an even more radical statement of, no, milamed zechut means once you have publicly articulated an argument to exonerate, you are not allowed to vote in that direction at all, okay? So that is the subject, basically, of this next sugya. How extreme is this statement? And this is where we get Rav's argument. Amar Rav, lo shanu ela bishat masa umatan, ava bishat gmar din, milamed zechut chozeru milamed chova. When you are in the final decision phase, okay, bishat gmar din, then sure, people who argued to exonerate can go back and say, no, here's why I think we should. That is to say, it's only about in the time that is deliberative, where it feels like things are still being sorted out, you're not allowed to be switching back and forth. There's a unidirectionality to that argument. But when it comes to voting, basically, that is to say, it's the Gemara Din, what's your argument? Where are you going? Of course, you're allowed to switch at that last minute. That's what Rav thinks. And now the sugya is going to attack that from various pieces of that narrative that we looked at. Meitivei. Okay, we're going to challenge from a Braita, from the Mishnah later on, that this does not seem to be the case. That is to say that Rav is wrong, that actually the ban on switching to conviction is absolute throughout the whole proceeding. How do we know? Well, look at the description. The machorat, the next day, this is after they've spent the night thinking about it in order to fulfill that requirement of capital cases. The machorat, mashkimim uva'in. They get up early and come. Hamizakeh omer ani hamizakeh, mizakeh ani bimkomi. Hamachayev omer ani hamachayev, umachayev ani bimkomi. Hamalamed chova, hamalamed zechut, hamalamed zechut, eino yachol lachzor lamed chova. That whole scene where people are reporting, how are they voting? And it says they're not allowed to switch. And just to make it clear, v'ha lemachorat gmar dinhu. And that is when they're reconvening in order to convict or acquit. And that's the context in which it says you can't switch. Okay, Gemara easily dispenses with this. Velita mich, really? I mean, according to your view, you think what you're saying makes sense? L'machorat masau matan mi leka? What do you think? There's no deliberation the next day? Meaning, you do have to sleep the night on the decision before you actually vote, but that doesn't mean you're banned from having deliberation on the next day. Of course, there's also a period of deliberation. Ki katane bishat masau matan. And in fact, that passage we can deflect and say the only sense in which they're not allowing you to switch sides for conviction in the direction of conviction, is during the deliberative phase. But when you get to Gmar Din, when you get to the actual vote, then you're allowed to switch your position. Okay, we can debate, do we think that's a compelling reading of that Mishnah? But in any event, that deflects that text from bothering Rav. So we need something else. Tashma, another text here. Tashma, danin elu keneged elu, so this is from a later part in the Mishnah, which we didn't see, which says, if you recall, you have to win a conviction in a capital case by two votes. So what happens if the vote comes out 12 to 11? And the Mishnah tells you, well, if it's 12 to 11, okay, you can't actually acquit 12 to 11, because it's 12 to 11. So what do you need to do? You have to have a prolonged discussion. The 12 have to argue it out with the 11, and really what it is the 11 have to argue it out with the 12 until one of the 12 comes to see it the way of the 11 and switches. Okay, that is say you can't proceed forward. You can't convict someone 12 to 11, but you need to actually end up with an acquittal of 12 to 11. So you got to switch someone to the other side. Ve'im ita, and if Rav were right, okay, if Rav were correct that you're allowed to switch, litnei nami ibcha, then it should have listed the opposite possibility too, right? It should have said, if you have a 12-11 deadlock, so you either have to get the 12 to switch to the 11 or the 11 to switch to the 12 so you can convict, 13 to 10, right? Why does it only go in the direction of switching 12-11 to 11-12? And that must be, says the Gemara, because you're not allowed to switch in the other direction, even at the voting phase, which we dismiss also as saying, Tana azechut kamahader, achova lo kamahader. The Tana here is trying to pursue, is sort of going out of his way to articulate the ways in which it might come out as an exoneration, and is not making an effort to tell how it might come about to be a conviction. That is to say, sort of literarily, stylistically, there's a preference for zechut, for exoneration here, but not because this text is taking a stance on the question of whether you can switch your vote in the voting phase of conviction. That, of course, you can do. Okay, one more. Tashma, the Amar Rabbi Yosef Bar Chanina, echad min atalmidim shezika v'meit, ro'ino to ki ilu hu chay ve'omed bimkomo. All right, so this is an amazing thing. So Rabbi Yosef and Rabbi Hanina is an Amora who is being brought here as a proof. So this is not a Tanaitic, you know, Mishnaic, Braita text, but a later text. If one of the students in the courtroom came up with an argument in favor and died before the trial was finished, you view him as if he is still alive, and ve'omed bimkomo literally means is still standing in his place, but it's also being used here figuratively. He's still sticking with his argument. That is to say, his argument remains hovering over the courtroom. You don't assume that he would have retracted. Okay? You don't assume that he would have heard some other things and backed out. You see him as if he is still there. Ve'amai, why do we do that? Neima ilu havakayam hadarbe. Okay? If he were still, why don't we say, well, who knows? He might have heard things that happened here and backed out. Meaning what? If Rav is right that you are allowed ultimately to switch your vote for conviction, okay, then we should not count the vote or count the position or give, you know, weight to the position of a Talmid who offered an argument for exoneration during the trial, but who didn't make it through to see the entirety of the trial because he ought to have been able to reverse his vote. From the fact that we don't entertain that, it must be he couldn't have reversed his perspective, and Rav must be wrong, that the ability to switch to conviction, the ban on switching to conviction is absolute. Here too, the Gemara dismisses by saying, Hashta mi alo hadarbe. No. Like, at the end of the day, he's at up to that point where he died, he didn't back out. And therefore, it remains. And you could even have Rav's position where you can switch your vote, but say that someone who argued in one direction but died, we still treat that as sort of frozen in time. So therefore, none of these texts so far are capable of shooting down Rav, which enables us to really actually say, oh, apparently there's some freedom here, maybe more than we thought, to switch. So now's our last attempt. V'hashalchu mitam l'divrei Rabbi Yosef bar Hanina motza michlal Rabbeinu. But there's a tradition that they sent from Eretz Yisrael that if you follow Rabbi Yosef bar Hanina, this last point about the student who dies and doesn't get to see the whole trial, you are sort of taken out of, excluded from full adherence to the words of our teacher, who is who? Rav. Let's go to Rashi here for a moment on the side. V'ashal humitam, klomar, hechi matzit litarutza lehad Rabbi Yosef bar Hanina kerav. How can you possibly come up with some explanation of Rabbi Yosef bar Hanina that will accord with Rav? The Hashalchu mitam, they sent from there, Eretz Yisrael, ledivrei Rabbi Yosef bar Hanina motza michlal Rabbeinu, that his words are, you know, literally like sort of taken out. They cannot be included in the words of our teacher Rav. Ha de Rabbi Yosef lo svira le de Rav de Amar bishat gmar din chozer lechova. They assumed that this was a machloket. And what is the resolution? The most literally violent resolution you could imagine? Ein motza itmar. No, actually, there was a word ein in that tradition. It didn't mean to say that this is excluded from the view of Rav. It meant that's not excluded. That could be reconciled with the words of Rav. Here in Rashi again, ein motza itmar, hachi shalchulei, L'divrei Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Hanina, ein motzin miklal divrei Rav. From the words of Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Hanina, you do not need to kind of be in conflict with what Rav said about switching your vote at the final moment. De tame de Rabbi Yosef, mishum de hashta mi aloha darbe. Because actually, Rabbi Yose's opinion is, as we said, at this moment in time, what we're concerned about is he hasn't yet backed out. Okay, we're going to try one more time to shoot Rav down. This is our, I think, what is this, our fifth or fourth or fifth attempt. Tashma, Shnei Sofrei HaDayanin Omdim Lifnei'en, Echad Min HaYamin VeEchad Min HaSmol, VeChotvin Divrei HaNezakin VeDivrei HaMechayvin. So part of the procedure is there's two scribes which sit there writing down, right, one on the right, one on the left, writing down the words of those who argue to acquit and the words of those who argue to convict. Bishlama divrei amechayvin lemachar chazutam achrina uvau lemevad halanat din. I understand why they bother to write down the arguments of the people arguing to convict. Why? Because tomorrow they might come up with a different basis. Chazutama achrina, they will see a different basis or reason for convicting. And when you switch reasons for conviction, you have to sleep on it another night. Ba'u le'me'evad tzrichim la'asot halanat din. Literally, letting the judgment sleep overnight. So you've got to make sure you're clear. This person argued to convict on this basis, because if they switch, we know we've got to extend the trial, as it were, another day. But, ela divrei mizakin, my tama. Why would we ever need to bother to write down the arguments of the people who are trying to acquit? Lav mishum de'ichazutama achrina lechova lo mashkechinan beho? Isn't it because if they end up saying, hey, I have an argument to convict, we want to say, excuse me, Dayan Ploni, I have you on record as arguing to acquit. You're not allowed to switch. That is to say, don't we keep a ledger of the Mizakin, because they are never allowed to switch, contra Rav, who imagines that they are allowed to switch at the last minute. Why bother writing that down if Rav is right? No, not right. You need to write them down for another reason. Kadei shelo yomru shnayim ta'am echad mishnei mikra'ot. Because you have to avoid them saying, two people saying one reason from two different verses. If two people give an argument for why this person should get off based on two totally different verses, but it's one argument, it's one legal articulation, one legal idea, but two people are citing it from two different verses, you need to keep track of that. Why? Kedeba'a minei Rabbi Asi me Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Asi once asked Rabbi Yochanan, Amru shnayim ta'am echad mishnei mikra'ot mahu. What happens if two people give the same argument, but they base it on two verses? Amar lei, ein monin lahen ela echad. They only count as one. Basically, those two votes get collapsed into one. Now, we have here a sort of interesting window. Again, hard to know how much of this is real, how much of this is imagined, how much of this really reflects. My instinct here is that this reflects not necessarily actual Tannaitic courts that are executing people, but it does indicate real things about the Tannaitic Academy or Tannaitic discussions and how they worked. We see here that when we talk about, right, in our terms, we usually think of like, oh, it's exculpatory evidence and this and that. But a lot of what's going on here, as we've seen, is literal arguments from the verse of the Torah, right? Think back to what we saw with Rabbi Yosef and Rabbi Hanina and who he's arguing with. They're literally plucking out a verse from Bamidbar Lamed Hei and suggesting, what does the word lamut mean, and how does it or doesn't it affect criminal procedure? Okay, so that shows you a culture where a lot of what you're doing is figuring out how is the Torah meant to be applied, and what are the verses that are the actual sources of the procedures that you're trying to put into play. And here the key thing is, if you've got two votes on the Sanhedrin to acquit, but they come from two different verses, the premise here seems to be those can't both be valid arguments. because it is not possible that the Torah can have two different textual groundings for one idea. We'll see in a minute. The reverse is obviously possible. And we even saw in that text I started off with, Eid Echad, Lo Ya'anev Nefesh Lamut, they're deriving all kinds of things from that verse. But the idea that I would say, the notion that, for instance, a Talmid, can speak up Lizchut, but not Lechovah, you can't ground that in two separate verses. Or more to the point, if two people are grounding them in two separate verses, you have kind of conflicting exegetical schema there. And think back even further back in our sugya, where it's like, well, what do the Chachamim do with that verse, right? There's this sort of assumption of, even if you don't need a one-to-one correspondence, you can't have two different verses feeding in to one legal conclusion. Yeah, you might think, doesn't it strengthen the theory, right? It's two verses supporting the same thing. In a sense, if the Torah is just there to help you read your argument, but if you are there to interpret the Torah, implicitly you are minimizing the meaning of every word and phrase in the Torah. You are making it redundant. You are making it not really add up. Yeah, Emily, good question. Like, are the only arguments legal arguments? I don't think they're the only ones. But I do think they are very prominent here. And I do think when you have the Talmidim, you really see that, right? Echad min ha-Talmidim, the only sense in which I think the Talmidim are weighing in is they're like, hey, I have an innovative way of thinking about it. Again, I've mentioned this before, if you've ever read Yochi Brandes's The Orchard or Hapardesh Shel Akiva, she spends a lot of time in that book trying to sort of reconstruct the Tanaitic Beit Midrash. And you get a great sort of fictional account of what it would have looked like for some young student like Rabbi Akiva, you know, then still Akiva, to come along and be like, well, I have a new way of reading this verse. And as a result, this person is gonna get off. And I do think she's capturing there in very effective fiction a sense of, I think, some of what's happening in this, in this sugya. So, it seems like they lose their vote. That's exactly what seems like it happens. Like, you need sort of distinct arguments, or right? They're doing something off. They sort of vote. They can't both be right. You could potentially have someone who would vote without proffering an argument, right? But the idea is once they've proffered two verses for the same argument, something is off there, okay? The name of the book is The Orchard by Yochi Brandes. In Hebrew, it's this. If you can do it in Hebrew, I strongly recommend. Okay, why is this not a reason for why the scribes need to write the convicting arguments? Say, do you want to just spell out your question? Fruma, you want to unmute and just articulate?
Yeah, like, we gave a reason for why the scribes have to write the convicting argument, which was so that if they change it, they can sleep over it overnight. Why doesn't this reason of having one argument with two different sources apply to that too?
Yeah, so just make sure I have the question clearly, right? The sugya said, the sugya was very confident, I know I've got to write the mechayvin because if they change arguments because of the halanat din, and you want to say, why wouldn't this cover it as well? I've got to write them down in order to keep on top of it. That is a good question. That is a good question. I'm just seeing if Rashi addresses this piece here, but I don't think he does. All right, I'm going to put that on my to-do checklist for next time. Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I can give you sort of the literary answer, which is, it seems like, right, they start off kind of not in that zone at all, right? And then they're stuck. They're like, we have a reason totally other than this with the mechayvin of why we need to do it. The mizakin, we think we've got you, Rav, right, on this proof. And then we're like, oh, actually, we came up with something else. And it's possible that maybe it does loop back around and it would cover that, right? Once you, hashta da'atit lahachi, as the Gemara would say, you know, it would come out the other way. But I want to think about whether there's another reason not and whether there's any interpreter that comes in on that. Great question, okay? Let's just see the last part here, and I want to show you one great, great Tosafot, and we'll end with that. So this is just the beginning. We're not going to get into the meat of it, which we'll leave for next time. But this is very nice also going into Shavuot. So the question now that the Gemara wants to ask is, Miname Mile. Like, how do we know that you cannot have two sources producing a single point of law? Like, where does that assumption come from? Can we ground it in the Torah itself? Or in Tanakh itself? Amar Abaye. The Amarkra achat diber Elohim, shtayim zu shamati, ki oz le'Elohim. So God spoke one thing, I heard two, for God has power. God speaks one thing, I hear two. Mikra echad yotze lechama ta'amim, ve'ein ta'am echad yotze mikama mikraot. So the first thing is, if God's singular word is capable of producing a multiplicity of meanings, it's sort of absurd and insulting to suggest the opposite. What, God would need to say two things in order to produce one thing? It's first of all, seems beneath God, but also just doesn't seem to be the way it works. That's a bias proof, right? This pasuk in Tehillim, God speaks one thing, we hear two. And then another famous image. Devei Rabbi Yishmael Tana, uchefatish yefotzetz sela. House of Rabbi Yishmael taught, it is like, the Torah is like a hammer that smashes a rock. Ma patish ze mitchalek lechama nitzotzot, af mikra echad yotze lechama ta'amim. Just as this hammer splits up into a couple of different sparks, so too a verse can go into several ta'amim. So here it's less about the power of God. Yes, you've got the great, the amazing meta piece of this sugya. Here it's not the power of God, but it is the notion of kifatish yifotzetzela, the metaphor that we use to describe Torah, is one where the patish, and that here seems to be Torah, but we'll come back to this in a minute, the patish is able to sort of come down and shatter the rock, and sparks fly out, and the rock is shattered, okay? That's the image for Torah. The word of God comes in and blows things apart in a million directions, all right? It doesn't consolidate. There's a sort of like expansive. There's a bomb radius to the Torah. Like that's really the image here. It is something that is explosive as opposed to concentrating. Okay. Now, first of all, we have this incredible thing, right? Of two derivations for the same idea. Now, of course, it's I think meta and literary way beautiful on a technical level. Okay, it's two separate people. Right, offering two different things. And if we were playing it out, we'd say, okay, well, what would Abaye think that verse has to be? And what would, you know, Devei Rabbi Yishmael think the other verse has to be? But there is definitely, I think, a meta reflection here on how this plays out. Great. But then there's this fascinating image in the Tosafot where they're trying to figure out exactly how does this hammer image work? And we'll just read this and we'll end with this. Ma patish zeh. So if you remember, just pay attention. The language here is, in the Gemara, ma patish ze mitchalek. Mitchalek is the hitpael. It is the reflexive conjugation of the verb. I read through it and was just like, the hammer is the agent of shattering and scattering and all of that. But that's what I'm going to say. Rabbeinu Shmuel, that's the Rashbam. Rabbeinu Shmuel Garis. He had a different reading. He didn't like mitchalek. He said michalek. It has to be the peel, It has to be the active and, in this sense, basically sort of transitive form of the verb, not reflexive form of the verb. Michalek, she'ein ha-patish mitchalek ela hasela. The hammer's not shattering into a million pieces. The rock is shattering into a million pieces. So the verb should be referring to the rock, not the hammer. Patish michalek, not patish mitchalek. V'kasheh. But this is hard, say the Tosfot. I get why the Rashbam said that, but it doesn't really work. Dehavale lememar mahasela mitchaleket. Well, you solved your transitivity problem, but you created a gender agreement problem, which is the sela is a female noun, and therefore it should have been mitchaleket, okay? And it should have been talking about that, not the patish, mechalek. It doesn't make sense. And in fact, also in Perek Rabbi Akiva, in Shabbat, garas, ma patish mitchalek lechama nitzotzot. Af kol dibur v'dibur sheyatza mipi HaKadosh Baruch Hu haya mitchalek l'shivim lashon. Here we have another agadic intertext where it's very clear that patish is what is parallel to the word of God. The patish is somehow, mitchalek is splitting up into many sparks, just as every utterance of God that emerged from God's mouth on Mount Sinai split into 70 languages. So here we get our Shavuot hook. The idea is that at the revelation at Sinai, everything that comes out of God's mouth goes into 70 different parts. If God's mouth is like the patish here, so then, yeah, the patish is mitchalek, not michalek. That is to say, the Tosfot are rejecting the Rashbam's rereading of the text. They're like, there's got to be a way that it makes sense with the hammer somehow splitting. Umefaresh Rabbeinu Tam. So Rabbeinu Tam explained it differently. Uchefatish yefotzet sela, shapatish mitchaleket min hasela. So Rabbeinu Tam said, no. What it means is that, yes, actually, the hammer gets shattered by the rock. Kedamrinan b'midrash, as we say in the midrash. This is where he's quoting from. Lamed from Eicha Rabba. Okay. Maase be'echad shelakach snapirim halach levodko נתנו על הסדן ויקאו בקורנס ונבקע הסדן ונחלק הקורנס וסנפירין עומד במקומו. היינו הוא דכתיב וחפתיש יפוצץ סלע. This image is used in Eicha Rabba to talk about someone who takes snapirin. They are not scales of a fish. They're another, like a piece of armor or something. I'll also check that, make sure I get the exact context from next time. You want to see how strong are they. And so you put them on the anvil, okay? And you hit them with a mallet. What happens? The anvil splits in two and the kurnas, the mallet breaks apart. That is to say, like the mallet and the handle sort of separate. And the thing remains there. The snapirin remain unaffected and intact. And that is the image of Uchefatish yefotzetz sela. Now, this then opens up, so this is sort of a debate of what this image is, but actually at its root, in a fascinating way, it's kind of a debate of what Torah is, which is to say, is Torah fundamentally to be described by the metaphor of it goes in and sort of spews light? It's like almost like the Torah, we're using a hammer imagery, but again, it's like the spark, it's like a prism. A single ray of light comes in and it's refracted into a full rainbow. All right, that's like one image where just the power of the Torah is sort of its multivocality and all the ways in which it spills that out. The competing image is the Torah is completely indestructible, immutable, and eternal. And what that means is everything that comes in contact with it will shatter. Right, for the Lord of the Rings fans, it's like the scene where Gimli takes the axe and shatters it down on the one ring, right? And it's like you have this desire to sort of somehow penetrate this with these strong tools that you have, won't succeed, okay? Nothing will happen. There are actually two amazingly different images of Torah that testify to Torah's power and its ability to sort of cast things off around it. But one of it is, no matter how hard we potentially sort of hit on the Torah, it will kind of show its truth and its integrity. And another is that the Torah is a force sort of for refraction, diffusion, creating multiple voices. And both of those, in different ways, by the Rashbam and Rabbeinu Tam, are being captured by this image. So I'll leave you that as our lead-in to Shavuot. Next time, next week, happy if folks have further comments here, but I want to allow people to go if you want to. We'll go a little deeper on some examples of this, of where are cases where we think that one thing can potentially produce two different weeks. Okay, I think we'll leave it there. Chag Sameach to everyone. Excellent. And looking forward to see you next Tuesday night.
Thank you.
Chag Sameach, thank you.
Chag Sameach, thank you.
Chag Sameach.